Then the next chapter that Swami talks about is really talking about, and in this chapter Swami includes most of the things that he did in SRF and Swami's and Master's way of relating to him in the next two chapters. Because Swami does this for several reasons. One is he really is trying to establish his credentials, because it's fair to ask, you know, well, what was your relationship with Master? You don't have to ask that in a challenging way. It's just a fair question to ask. I often, when I would teach Meditation One, I would explain to people what the lineage was. I would say to them, you know, you just walked in here. You probably don't even care, but I have to tell you that it is important. You want to know where what you're being taught came from, and you need to understand that it's not coming from me. I just didn't make this up. This is an ancient lineage, and it's a noble lineage that has a lot more to give you than just some person with a good idea. And when Swamiji himself writes, when he first, in the path, he said, when he first came to Mount Washington, and he knew so little that everything he heard was just startling to him. And sometimes he would hear things that were so beyond his imagination of expectancy that he just didn't know what to do. And he would always ask, did Master say that? And if Master said it, even if he couldn't understand it, he also couldn't reject it. And the source of what was being said was very, very important, because if it was just something that somebody read in a book or heard from so-and-so, I know even now, whenever I hear anything unusual spiritually, I always ask, well, who said it? You know, what's the source for that? So Swamiji really wants us to know, these are the things that Master actually said to me. These are the things that Master expected of me. But there was such a quirk on this that only came clear to Swamiji later, which is almost all the time that Swamiji was with Master, much of the time he was alone with him. And everything that was important that Master said to him, there were no witnesses. And even more than that, he never said any of these things when any of those who in future had influence. He never said any of it in the hearing of Dayamata or any of the other women on the board of directors. And it seems clear he never spoke to any of them about Swamiji either. It just was, and Swami, of course, had no way of knowing this. You have to appreciate that it was a very strict monastery. And Swami did, over the years, work a lot with Dayamata, and he became the only man on the board of directors. But as a rule, the men and women didn't mix. And during the years that Master was alive, Swami was just a junior monk, even though once he actually even became the head of the monks, but he was still just a junior player. He was there for a long, long time before he even saw Dayamata. He just sort of heard about her. And it was only after Master passed that he really had any real contact with her. So he really wouldn't know what Master was saying to others. And he didn't expect that his word alone would not be respected. You know, he was and always has been so utterly honest. Even his mother said, when all of the lawsuit came down on us and he was accused of being a liar, his mother, of course, who would be generous and sweet that way, said, he quoted his mother. He said, but he could never lie. Even as a tiny child, he could never tell a lie. It was just his nature, Swami's nature. He was so trained as a yogi. He had nothing to defend, and truth is so fundamental to the spiritual path. So he tells us, and the cumulative effect of the things Master said are very interesting. I don't know if Swami includes, and this comment that he made repeatedly, that you have a great work to do, also, it just had such power over Swami, as he says, and it wasn't to him, it wasn't a compliment, it was a command, it was a commission. And also he writes so interestingly about how Master expected certain things of him because he saw that was Swami's natural inclination. And there's a very important teaching there also, because so often we think that God makes us do things, and the more contrary, the less we want to do it, the more it must be God's will. The way Swami put it to me once, he said, God doesn't necessarily want you to be unhappy. No. Now, Master also said to Swami, when Swami said, I don't want to be a lecturer, Master said, living for God is martyrdom. You know, you better get used to it. It's what you have to do. Because there was a reluctance on Swami's part to push himself forward. But what Master was really responding to is this profound desire within Swamiji to help people. And it was just a matter of the guru like taking the natural energy and then finding a way to direct it. And it brought Swami, it forced Swami to take a role that he wouldn't have solicited for himself. But the purpose of that role, as he describes himself, you know, for years he just lectured without really being committed to it, and then he really saw, this is really helping people. And the desire to help people was so strong in him that then he overcame. And he writes, I don't know if it's in here or in another book, he writes that he's always had this great dilemma. On one hand, he just has a hermit's nature, and he would just love to just spend all his time in solitary meditation and never see anyone. He said, and the other problem is that as soon as he experiences a little bit of joy, he just can't wait to go out and share it with someone. And these two forces are always conflicting within him. And that's sort of exactly what you see. He just can't wait to share it. He's so, a music or a book or whatever it is, he's just so excited, so exhilarated to pass it on. So Master really worked profoundly and strongly, and just as he said, commissioned him. But what you also see in Swami's life, played out very slowly, is a lot of what St. Francis went through. St. Francis felt the call, profound call to renounce the world, and he walked out of his parents' comfortable home in the town of Assisi. His father was one of the wealthiest merchants in Assisi, and he was the cherished only son, and he had the whole town at his feet. He was the troubadour and so popular. Everything was there for him. And then he had this experience of going to war and being in prison and being ill, and then at the end of it, he just renounced it all. And it was so, when you think of the story of Francis, it's so amazing, is that he didn't leave Assisi. He just left his parents' home and went out to live in the woods, and they would come back every day and beg for food at the same houses where he'd been an honored guest. He would stand in the public marketplace and preach like somebody who was pazzo, crazy, you know. But it was right in his own town, his hometown. And his parents had to see him, and all the people. I mean, the relinquishment of ego and pride was extraordinary. But he left his family and went out there to live this austere life in the forest, but he didn't know what else he was supposed to do. And he found this ruin of a chapel, and he was sitting in there and he was praying, Lord, what do you want me to do? I'm following your wishes, but now what? And the crucifix, it was a painted crucifix, which many of you have seen, the models of it, or the imitations of it, are everywhere. And Jesus came alive for him and said, rebuild my church. Can't you see it's in ruins? And so Francis, because it was so thrilling to him, he looked around, and indeed, the little chapel he was sitting in was a ruin. So he rebuilt it. He got bricks and mortar and just made a new church there. And then he rebuilt several other churches, and he made an innovative construction for a new kind of arch and all these, you know, he just really threw himself into it, and he begged the materials, and then he started drawing monks and so on. But that wasn't what Christ really meant. Christ meant that the entire Catholic Church was tottering. And eventually, of course, Francis, you know, had the audience with the Pope, and the Pope himself had a dream of the entire, of the huge St. Peter's collapsing, and only little Francis was holding it up. And the Pope got the rest of the vision, but Francis could only understand it a step at a time. Well, Swamiji here, he's 22 years old, maybe 23 by the time Master says, you have a great work to do. And he's just an eager lad, and Swami has, yes, given him the responsibility to be in charge of the monks, and he's teaching, and he's giving kriya, but it's just, what could he think of? And at that time, too, it was not a movement for young people. Almost everybody in the churches, if there was anybody under 40, it was a great moment. And Swami's 22. That's part why Master had him grow the beard, so he just wouldn't look like such an untried youth. And Swami just did what was in front of him. He himself describes it so sweetly. He said, I didn't really know what Master meant, but I knew that if I just worked energetically and enthusiastically with whatever was there, that somehow it would come to me. I mean, that's a profound and life-changing teaching just right there. We sometimes think, oh, I can't put out any energy until I'm certain. You see the human tendency that wants to bring it into form all the time? It's that same institutional desire. I have to have it all spelled out before I can do anything. But Swami just, Master said, you have a great work to do. He didn't have a clue as to what that was. So he would do whatever he had to do with as much greatness as he could bring to it. And he just flowed in really directions that were not what Master had in mind. And it's one of the reasons it took Swamiji a while to figure out what was really expected. He assumed it would be an SRF. He never even imagined it wouldn't be an SRF. There was no Master's work except SRF. That was just it. I mean, really, Master came and started SRF. You would naturally think if you were going to serve him, you would serve him in what Master had started. Why would you even think anything else? And so he became, even by his own words, the quintessential organization man. Paradoxically, when we went through the SRF trial, oh God, and it was just such a comedy. I mean, such it was so ludicrous is the word you actually want to use, because it was very serious, but it was ludicrous. And SRF was, I don't know what they were thinking, but their lawyers would pull out these letters that Swamiji had written in 1955, 1956, 1957, when he was in charge of the center department and was representing the party line. And there were certain things that Swami said about SRF and about Master's will for SRF and so on that were consistent with what SRF is asserting now in the 90s, 1997, 98, 99. And they would try to sort of, you know, say that somehow Swami was a dishonest person because in 56 this is what you said. I mean, ludicrous. It was just ludicrous. We would just, I just watch open mouthed, and Swami would just like try to explain. But in fact, he sort of said to us later that he was the quintessential organization man. He organized all of SRF. And he points out that he organized all of SRF. That's why he lists it out here. He said the structure that they follow now, he started, he said, much to his everlasting regret. He was the one who did it. And he did it sincerely because he somehow thought that's what Master wanted. And it wasn't he describes that in here. It wasn't actually till he went to India. What happened to him when he went to India, I don't think he says it quite as frankly in here as he said it in private. Because by the time he left Mount Washington to go to India, he was really glad to get out of there because he just couldn't bear the smallness of the way people thought. He just wanted a little elbow room. But when he left, there was still no real chink in his commitment to Daya and the way she was doing things. And when he went to India, what happened was, because also he'd never ever discussed the future of the work with Master in any particular way. And that's one of the things he comments in here that he realizes now, that Master never talked to him about the direction of SRF, ever. All Master ever talked to him was how to help people. And in retrospect, Swami realizes, because he was never going to be involved in that. So when Daya and others told him how Master wanted it, he never had any reason to doubt that, because he had nothing to counter it. He had an intuitive question, but he didn't really have anything. But when he went to India, he realized that she was wrong. Because when he got there, he really saw how universal this was, and how that whole institutional approach just simply could not have been what Master intended. And Daya said to him years later that India ruined you. Because it did. It ruined him for the role that he had been in before. But he said it separated him from, it enabled him to think for himself. It restored to him non-institutional religion. You see, what's so interesting. I'll say just one last thing completely unrelated to this book, and then we'll close for tonight. One of the things that Swamiji has done since he's been in India is write out what he calls the way of Ananda Sangha, which I've shared with you all, and some of you may have gotten it in the mail now, which is the clearest, most non-sectarian, most universal movement of self-realization, expression of what Ananda is doing that he's ever created. He tried several times in America to launch something like this, but it always got sucked back into being Ananda. It sort of got sucked back into the grand central sun of our churches and our central ministry. We just couldn't help ourselves. And he's trying it again there. But there it'll probably work, because that is really what the spirit of India is. They've kept it alive all these years because they've always understood that it's between you and God. And then in this paper that we haven't really shared too much yet, but we will, Swamiji, first he describes, you know, what it really is to be on the spiritual path without making any reference to Ananda at all or even to our line of masters. And then he just makes the simple statement, and we seek fellowship with those who share our ideals. And that just defines it. That's the whole of spiritual organization, isn't it? Which is that you seek fellowship with those who share your ideals, because you do it out of natural affinity and you do it for support. Beginning and end of the story. Once it goes beyond that, and of course, life being what it is, you have to pull things together in a certain way. But that's all it's about. And keeping it so clear, keeping first principles so obvious, is what will enable us all both to realize God and to live within the human structures that are required, but to do so without losing the spirit of God within them. All right, comments or questions, or will that do it for this time? Okay, if you pick up that piece of paper, we're reading about 3 more chapters. As I said, it depends on the length of the chapters, but let's see, I marked it out in here. We read through chapter 7 for next week. Okay, see you then.